I'm Executive Director Liz Joyner of the Village Square, and on behalf of the Village Square Board of Directors and their families, I'd like to welcome you to Wall Street, Main Street, and whatever happened to Easy Street. It is my pleasure now to introduce our moderator for the evening. Dr. Carol Weissert is the director of the Leroy Collins Institute, professor of political science at Florida State University, and editor of Publius, the Journal of Federalism. She was the author with David Denslow of Tough Choices, Shaping Florida's Future, and co-authored several reports on the relationship between state and local government in Florida. I often tell panelists that what we want to have for the evening is almost as if we're eavesdropping on a living room conversation between our panelists, and I don't know anybody more than Carol, who probably actually has conversations like this in her living room, so she'll be great this evening. While Carol is making her way up to our temporary living room for her, I want to mention that we're going to have a couple civility bells out in the audience, and actually I haven't distributed them yet, but they're little librarian debt bells. Ding, ding, ding. And I'll give one to a conservative and one to the liberal, and that will their job will be the daunting task of keeping this conversation civil. And so I just want to remind everybody that despite the fact that we disagree on some issues, that we're going to have a really good civil and constructive conversation this evening. Also want to mention that one of the things we found that sort of gets in the way of a good civil conversation is what we call team clapping. It's really easy to sort of start clapping for the side that you agree with. And we find that when you do that, we sort of all stop listening. So if you can maybe just keep the clapping down and just listen. Carol.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming out on this lovely Tallahassee day to talk about the economy. We're going to talk tonight about Florida's economy. How is it faring? And more importantly, what can be done to improve it? The economy is complicated enough and difficult enough that sometimes we have a hard time figuring out exactly what we should be even thinking about with the economy, right? Unemployment, consumer confidence, new job growth, or whatever. And part of that is that I think the economists obfuscate things a lot. And so what I did in preparation for tonight, sorry, my dean is in the back raising his hands. He's an economist. But what I did for tonight was I Googled economist jokes. And believe me, there are a lot of them. And I said to somebody, I really enjoyed it. My husband had a really good time laughing at the jokes that I'm going to tell you one or two. But I thought, well, I'll just Google political scientist jokes. There's one. So I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I don't think it's particularly good. So here's my first economist joke. How many economists does it take to change a light bulb? None. If the government would just leave it alone, it would screw itself in. There's another one. We'll see how it goes. I've got a lot, but well, it's one more that's worth telling. So tonight we're going to shed some light on the state of Florida's economy with two frontline experts on the economy. Both are advocates of small business in Florida, which has often been seen for the engine for economic growth. Both are well known to the people in this room and across the state as policy leaders, and both dabble a bit in politics now and then. I'd like first to introduce Alex Sink. Alex is presently the senior advisor with Tampa, Florida-based Hyde Park Capital. She is currently serving as founder and chair of the Florida Next Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization focused on diversifying Florida's economy through the growth of small business and entrepreneurship. She served as Florida Chief Financial Officer from 2007 to 2011, and in 2010, she was the state's Democratic nominee for governor. Prior to elected office, she had a 26-year career with the Bank of America, and she retired as president of Florida operations in 2000. She's been a statewide business leader, serving as chair of Leadership Florida and a whole variety of things, including the Florida Council of 100. Alex resides in Thonotosassa. Is that close enough? Sorry, I have it written here, and I still can't pronounce it. With her husband and attorney, Bill McBride, and they have two children. And so I want to welcome Alex to the stage at this point. Thanks, Alex. And our second speaker at this point in the program is Mark Wilson. He is the president and chief executive officer of Florida's largest and most influential business advocacy organization, the Florida Chamber of Commerce. The Florida Chamber focuses on creating a business climate that generates prosperity and high-paying jobs, vibrant communities, and global competitiveness in the state of Florida by focusing on job creation and the six pillars of Florida's future economy. He created the Florida Business Agenda, the Florida Chamber Grassworks Network, which mobilizes the business community on issues ranging from taxes to talent to insurance and constitutional amendment reform. Wilson has also been very active in constitutional amendment votes in Florida. In 2010, he served as treasurer and co-chair of the Vote No on Number 4 campaign, an anti-growth proposal. He also has served in a wide variety of leadership positions, including Leadership Florida, the Florida Council of 100, and many others. Mark King to the Florida Chamber in 1998, having served as vice president of the Chicagoland Chamber and previously served with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He lives in Tallahassee with his wife, daughter, and two sons. Would you welcome Mark Wilson? Okay, now here's the drill. We're going to have a discussion initially on some state economic issues. And I have some questions that I'm going to initially ask them. But if you've got questions you want in a little while, then we'll get your questions, or you can write them down on a piece of paper. We want this to be interactive. And then we also have Don Winstead join us, who's going to be talking about the federal role, and then we'll continue on from that discussion. But right now, we're going to just have a brief discussion with my questions, and then we'll get to your questions. Hopefully, they will be questions that you will agree with. Okay, first of all, my speakers, what is your assessment of the Florida economy today? We get a lot of different variables, a lot of different measurements, but what's really going on in Florida's economy? Alex, you want to start?
Thanks, and I'm thrilled to be here tonight. Thanks to all of you for coming, and let's honor Bill Law, who, as you know, is now in the St. Petersburg area, and I understand he's going to start a village square in St. Petersburg. So good for Bill Law. So what's going on with Florida's economy now? Things are getting better. We saw last week that the unemployment numbers were out, and they are down once again to about 9%. And most importantly, we appear to be at least closing the gap somewhat between Florida's unemployment level and the national average, which is about 8.2. Remember, we were 2 percentage points above the national average. But the story is somewhat mixed because while more people are back at work, which is what we need to have happen, and jobs were added last year, the Tampa Bay Times recently reported that of the additional jobs from last year, the average salary of those jobs is 25% less than the jobs that we lost. So the challenge for us going forward is how are we going to build the new Florida, which is not a Florida that's based on primarily tourists and retirees coming back to our state in droves.
Mark, your assessment.
Okay, well, thank you. I actually agree with everything that was just said. I think that when you look at where our economy is in Florida, It's hard to separate what the federal government's doing from what we can do here in Florida, because there are so many regulatory frameworks that make our way into Florida. So what we can do is compare how are we doing against other states, even with that as a backdrop. And so big picture, I agree. Florida's absolutely headed in the right direction. The voters feel that Florida's headed in the right direction. The job numbers are headed in the right direction. Unemployment's headed in the right direction. Big picture, if you look out 10 years, in the next few years, Florida will pass New York as the third largest state in the nation. So our population's headed in the right direction. The decision a few years back to diversify Florida's economy, agriculture, tourism, and construction, will always be the first floor of Florida's economy. So we're never going to go back there. But the question is, how quickly can we compete globally? How quickly can we align our education system with our economic development system, with our regulatory and tax system? So if as I've said hundreds of times, if Florida were a stock, if you could buy stock in all 50 states, you would want to buy all the stock in Florida because the fundamentals are absolutely headed in the right direction. We've made the right choices, and I think that's being proved out. 14 out of the last 15 months, the job numbers have headed in the right direction. And Florida, on a national stage, we're the only state in the nation that over the last two legislative sessions, we didn't raise on small businesses a single tax or a single fee. We're the only state in the nation that can claim that. And people around the nation are beginning to realize that we're serious about being open for business. So I think we're headed in the right direction. It's a very tenuous time. We're nowhere close to out of the woods, and we need a lot of leadership for sure.
I think one of the things people are concerned about is sort of, do the consumers agree with you? Does the public agree? What does the public think about the economy today in Florida?
When I speak with many small business roundtables around the state to talk about the issues of the future and of course, to introduce the purpose of the Florida Next Foundation, mainly Florida is a state of small businesses, and these are the things, Carol, that they tell me they're most concerned about. Number one is access to capital. Many small businesses have been starved because there hasn't been an opportunity to have that great idea and be able to go to their local bank and get the capital they need to grow their business. Certainly, as Mark said, the federal government does have a role and has had a huge influence because the Small Business Administration has begun to do more lending specifically to small businesses. Secondly, they talk about, and Mark, maybe the legislature hasn't increased taxes, and I think that's good on small businesses, but in their mind, a tax is just another expense, like the one that they complain most about is double-digit increases in the cost of providing health insurance to their employees. So regardless of what happens with the Supreme Court decision, this issue of enormous cost increases in health insurance is a very critical one. They talk about regulation. And then fourthly, they talk about things like, I have jobs, but I can't fill all my jobs because I can't find people with the right talent to fill my jobs. So I know we'll get more into these education issues, but those are the issues that many, many businesses around the state are very concerned about.
So healthcare, regulation, and education, they're really, really key. Mark?
Yeah, I think so. So you asked what are the voters, what do the people of Florida think about what's going on in the economy? Well, we ask them every month. We do a lot of voter polling at the Florida Chamber. And in this country, most Americans think we're headed in the wrong direction. And most Americans are concerned about India and China, and we're losing our competitive edge on a global scale. And right here at Florida, more people in Florida think we're headed in the wrong direction, too. And so when you hear me say the economy's headed in the right direction, we're talking about the actual metrics, what an economist would look at. But your question is, how do people feel? Right now, we just did a poll. 35% of voters think Florida's headed in the right direction, and 44% think we're headed in the wrong direction. Now, 6 months ago, it was 64% wrong direction, 27% right direction. So people are beginning to equate. People are getting back to work. People are getting jobs. And every month that we increase the number of jobs, there seems to be a correlation between the confidence that the voters have that Florida's back on the right track. So, again, it's tenuous, and we have a long ways to go. But in terms of what the voters think we're beginning to get more in the right direction, but they still think we're mostly in the wrong direction. And that's a national number. They think Florida's headed more in the right direction than the federal direction, though.
So is that sort of an indictment on our legislature and our governor that they should have been doing more than they have done?
Well, you know, the economy is complex, and so it's not, you can't really point the finger at any one person or one entity. As Mark was talking about whether or not people think that we're headed in the right direction or not, what occurred to me was that we'll probably have an interesting debate this fall between President Obama and Governor Scott about who's responsible for whatever it is that's going on in the Florida economy. There is a sense that while we're in the current moment, I think that there is a discouraging sense about not addressing some of the important issues of the future. Who is out there really talking about what we want the future of our state to be like? What is going to be, how do we educate our students for the jobs of the 21st century? We did a poll that it's on our website, Florida Next, that indicated that 70% of Floridians believe that we are not educating our students for the jobs of the 21st century. That is a big issue and a big problem. So what's missing is that we might be living in the moment, but we need more leadership from all sectors, from the private sector, from the public sector, from Tallahassee government people, but also from local government people about how we build a better future for our state longer term.
Yeah, so I think what we have to look at is, so what are the facts in terms of why people feel the way they do? Your question was, has the legislature, the governor, have they just not done enough? I think they've done plenty. And I think the first thing we have to realize is government doesn't create any jobs. The private sector creates jobs. So the first thing that I would reject, it wasn't your question, but the government doesn't create jobs. And what we want them to do is create a business climate where small businesses feel safe to take a risk. There's more money, more than $2 trillion, sitting on the sidelines in the United States right now because companies are afraid to invest in the U.S. market right now. Because the regulations are changing, the rules are changing. They want some assurances that we're not going to keep changing the rules and regulations. And so I, frankly, would rather have the legislature say, we're going to do nothing for 5 years, keep the rules the way they are, than be like Washington, where we've said, don't worry, the rules are going to change every 15 minutes. It puts capital on the sidelines, and I think that's a very real issue we have to be aware of.
I want to add something about this notion about government not creating jobs, because I was in a conversation with an entrepreneur who's in Gainesville, Florida recently. This is an entrepreneur who took some research out of the University of Florida and built a very, very enormously successful company that regenerates nerve tissue out of it. And he said, Alex, government does create jobs. It creates the research jobs in universities, out of which come more private sector jobs. You could argue that teachers in public schools are government employees. So we just have to be careful about the language that we use. Yes, we have to have an economy that's built on the private sector, but we have to value and appreciate those state employees who are working hard and toiling every day to keep consumers safe, whether it's food safety or environmental safety. And we have to especially value the investment that we make in hiring professors and researchers that generate these ideas that then can be privatized in the private sector.
We're actually cutting the funds to higher education in Florida. There's people in this room know $300 million this year. Yeah. So what is your role? What is your view, Mark, on the role of higher education as a job creator?
So those two questions, I think, are very related. So a little bit on that. I think that where we may have a little disagreement, maybe not, is I think that the goal should be to grow the private sector. The way you generate more tax revenue for a local or a state or a national government is to generate more economic activity, which generates more sales, which generates more tax revenue. So I believe teachers, good teachers, should earn $100,000 or more a year. Absolutely, it's the most important thing we can do in this nation, not just in this state. I also believe that research, particularly from our higher ed research facilities, that can be commercialized, is one of the best assets that this community and that this state has. So I think that the best way to generate more investment in research is to generate more economic activity. I don't believe that the best way to generate more private sector growth is to put more money into the government sector. So there's common disagreements on that. But I think your question as the role of higher education, I will say this. I think there's no more important issue that we should focus on than talent generation in this state. And I would say to have a discussion about higher ed without including pre-K, without including K-12, without including the workforce system after you leave the university or the state college, it's all part of one system. And 2011 was the first time that the business community was able to get the leaders of all four zones of education to actually sit around the table at the same time and say, wait a second, the fifth grade curriculum actually ought to be tied to the jobs that fifth grader is going to have down the road when they enter the workforce. If anybody in this room thinks today's third grade, fifth grade, seventh grade curriculum has anything to do with the job skills that we know are going to be needed when they graduate high school or graduate college, there's absolutely no correlation. And so we've got to fix the system, and we've got to invest. We've got to look at return on investment. And I think we need to invest significantly more in higher education, significantly more in pre-K and in K-12. But we have to have an ROI discussion. What are we going to get for that? And I'll end my comment by saying this. There was a time 25 years ago when the United States ranked number one of the top 25 countries in education outcomes in our K-12 system. Today, we're not even in the top 20. Yet we spend more per student than the top 20 do. So if money were the answer, I'd be sitting up here saying, let's don't worry about ROI, let's just put more money in. We have to have a tough discussion in this country about what are our outcomes that we want from education. So I think there's a lot woven into your question, and I just happen to think it's the most important issue we need to focus on.
A couple of weeks ago, I attended a very interesting conference. It was sponsored by my alma mater, Wake Forest University, and it was called Rethinking Success, How the Liberal Arts Prepares Students for the 21st Century. And as you are, many of you are aware, there have been discussions and issues around what does it mean to have a liberal arts education? Is it relevant anymore? There's all this attention and STEM, it's on and on and on. So they pulled together representatives from about 70 colleges and universities from all around the country, all the way from the Michigan State University, University of Virginia, to Davidson College, Lester. And I could spend the whole night sharing with you some of these ideas, but I'll shorten it up a lot. This is what I learned in the extensive notes that I took. Condoleezza Rice came in, and she was the keynote speaker, talking about the importance of higher education, that this country still is the gold standard for providing higher education. Everybody from around the world still wants to come to the United States to go to college or go to university here. But what is it, what do employers want? And we had employers there from Microsoft, from IBM, from many other large companies. And this is what they said. We don't care what students major in. What we care about is they have critical thinking skills, that they are good in written communications, that they are strong in oral communications, that they are problem solvers, and that they know how to work in groups. And when I came back and discussed this with our intern from the Bob Graham Center and said, James, this is what I heard. Is this what you're getting? He said, no. He said, most of what I've gotten in my 4 years has been online courses. We sit in front of computers and we study and cram for bubble test. So my question is, how are our students, our best and brightest students who are going to university all over this state, and of course you have one of the flagships right here, how are we preparing them for this world of work in which they have to learn how to work in groups and they've never seen a professor, or they've never worked on a group project, or they haven't written very many research papers. This is the issue of the day for us, I believe, as Floridians, is to figure out how we truly are going to educate and give our kids, our brightest kids, and all of our kids the exposure that they need to be able to communicate and survive and thrive. And, of course, this was a little self-serving, but, you know, those of us who had liberal arts educations understand that that's the kind of experience we got over and over again in those English. And, by the way, math and science are part of the liberal arts, so it's not exclusive.
I think we have a point of consensus on the importance of higher education. I might say if somebody is in higher education, our classes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger because we don't have the money. So it's a never-ending problem that they're getting even less well-educated, because if you have 235 students in the classroom, you don't assign research papers.
That's right. You don't assign any papers, I can imagine, because you can't possibly read them.
Yeah, and the classes have grown larger and larger and larger. So I think that's really important.
I wanted to make a comment on that. I think that is there's a dialogue, I think, in the state that needs to happen. And so we're going to add 6 million more people by 2030. And if you just think of what that means to our education system, I think what we need to do is we need to acknowledge that many of our universities and state colleges are doing a remarkable job serving their customers. What I think there's a common theme that I would imagine Alex and I would agree on, whether you want to talk about energy or water or transportation or higher education, what the state lacks is any sense of a long-term goal or any sense of a long-term plan. There's no 10-year, 20-year, 30-year. So if the question was, so is University X or State College Y meeting the goal that we have for it? No one in this room could answer that question because there's no state higher purpose. If you go to North Carolina or California, or you mentioned Michigan, this is a state imperative. University of or in North Carolina, they get 6% tuition increases from the legislature every single year. And there's only a tuition increase if the state legislature doesn't have the money to put it back in. So if you're a researcher or a professor in North Carolina, you have a forever promise that you're precious to the state. And I don't want to I can't criticize anybody in leadership, in past leadership administrations that were not there. But I think we just have to have a dialogue about if we're going to talk about the future, about what's next in Florida, I think we all have to talk about whether that's going to be what's important to us. All the data I've seen is that's the most important conversation, is where do we want to be? Not where have we been. We all kind of own where we've been, but we all get, if we want to, we all can decide where do we want to go. And I think where we want to go would rally us together, no matter what political stripe you might come from.
There is a bill that's on the governor's desk that many people in this room are well aware of that would set some standards for the universities. And the University of Florida and Michigan State University meet enough of those standards that it would give them more flexibility in terms of their use of dollars. But importantly, it does set these are standards that universities in Florida should meet. Does that sort of fit what you're talking about here, or do you want something else?
Well, if that question's to me, I don't think there's any silver bullet. Standards are good. Standards require a conversation about, you know, do we want to benchmark against California, Michigan, North Carolina? And to give assurances to taxpayers and students that there's minimum standards that are being met, that's always a good thing. I think that in this state, we tend to say, okay, we did the standards thing. You know, now we're done with higher ed for a while. Okay, there are dozens of things we need to do just in higher ed. To help higher ed and to help students and to help the faculty and the researchers. So I don't think there's any one silver bullet. I think that standards is a very important move in the right direction.
Let me add that we're talking a little bit about the quality of the experience or the quality of the education, but something came up in a forum that I was attending the other day that's also out there. It's called affordability. Florida ranks very low, even though we're in a tuition-low state. Believe it or not, we rank low in terms of access to higher education because we've built our system around very little needs-based aid. And I had a dad stand up the other day and say that he has a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. when his four-year-old was born, he went and bought a prepaid plan, and I think he said it cost somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000. So when the second child was just born, he went back to buy a prepaid plan. And guess what? The cost of a prepaid plan now is $45,000. And that's because they have had to build in the expectation of these 15% year after year increases in the cost of higher ed. So we have a real issue brewing in our state about accessibility and affordability. And my question is, if we are permitting tuition to increase by these really enormous amounts, in 5 years it'll be doubled what it is today, then what is happening with that money? The answer may be, well, that's just making up for the defunding on the part of the legislature. But what I want to hear also is, well, with this incremental revenue we're getting, we're going to increase our needs-based aid for those families and those kids who are smart and bright and need to have access to higher education, and we're going to make our classes smaller.
Amen to that. In fact, I would relate that back to all four zones. If you go all the way back to fourth grade, you know, if you look at the prison population and what it's going to be 15 years from now, all you got to do is look at today's third and fourth grade reading scores, and it's very predictable. So I think the more we can tie these outcomes to what kind of an economy we want, I would wholeheartedly endorse much more needs-based accessibility for kids who want to go into college and university. It, again, let's remember, it's not for everybody. We used to have much more vocational training, and it used to be cool to be a carpenter or to go into the trades. And somehow this country, we've sort of said, well, if you can't get into university, then you could do that. There's people making six figures that are plumbers in this town. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I just think we got to get back there.
Thank you. Okay, well, we may come back to this higher education issue because I know it's important to many people in this room. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the tax system in Florida. The current recession has really exposed Florida's serious over-reliance on housing prices and on new residents as drivers of growth. One national magazine called Florida the Ponzi State, because we kept building on people coming in. Now that we may be coming out of the recession, or out of the devastating housing slump, have we made any changes that show that we learned something about our tax system?
I'll jump in. I'm not bashful. Unfortunately, I would say no. In our state, we just don't learn. We're like, okay, we're out of the woods. The housing market's coming back, and we don't make any changes. So one in eight mortgage foreclosures in the nation are in Florida right now. And the mortgage foreclosures actually fund part of the court system. So if you want more money for the courts, then put more foreclosures through the system. It makes no sense. You can't make this stuff up. And then you have people who want out of their home. They literally want to go to the bank and turn back in the keys. And then my friends at the Trial Lawyer Association say, no, there's no reason to leave your house. You can stay in there. So 458 days right now is essentially the average time to get through a foreclosure in this state. So if you, I agree that the economy is headed in the right direction, but if you look at the biggest anchor we have around it right now is the problems we're having getting out of our housing crisis. And the last big crisis we have is the mortgage foreclosure crisis. Now, on the tax system, we have some low-hanging fruit in this state. The e-fairness issue, the internet sales tax fairness issue, is completely unfair to small businesses in this community and throughout this state. And whether you want it to be tax neutral or whether you want to take the $1 billion that's estimated to come from it, what we need is to generate more economic activity. And there are certain taxes like the internet sales tax that make perfect sense. But your underlying question is, did we learn anything? We may have learned a lot, but I'm not sure. Other than some of the minor, very minor property tax changes that have been made along the way, we need to take a look at fundamental tax reform in this state. I don't think even the Great Recession we just went through has caused a big rallying cry on the tax side, unfortunately.
Let me just add that the other day I spoke to a legal women voters group down in Manatee County, and as I was preparing and going on their website, they had listed all of the constitutional amendments that will be on the ballot this fall. I know you've seen them, Mark, but I hadn't seen them, and they're scary. And there are many of, or several of them, that have to do with tax issues, of limiting tax increases. This bill that was commonly referred to as Tabor, Taxpayer Bill of Rights, is on the constitutional amendment. I guess I can see it passing, but that would be passage of that kind of concept would be very, very bad for our state. The people of Colorado tried it. And when it came up, when I was the CFO, they called our office and said, Alex, do not let this happen because it can destroy our bond rating. It can have all sorts of unintended consequences. And to start putting issues like that in the Constitution is just a very, very dangerous thing for the fiscal health of our state.
So what's it going to take to do the tax reform that we need? Is it just hopeless? Dear, this is a depressing thought.
Well, I think, and not to change the subject, but I think term limits are really not what everybody thought they would be, because we're living in a state right now where if Alex and I wanted to say, hey, let's look at the tax code, what's the right thing to do 10 years from now? That's not that very far down the road if you're thinking about tax policy. Problem is, there's not an elected official in the Capitol right this second who can stay here 10 years. So all of a sudden, it's, well, what's that going to look like on my next election? Is somebody going to hit me with a tax increase? And so the challenge to tax reform is that the voters don't want it. So, we poll this stuff all the time. And if I told you, I tell you what, we're going to fix our property tax problem. And here's what we're going to do. All of you who are homesteaded property owners are going to pay a lot more so the rest of us don't have to pay as much. Those of you who are homesteaded, vote. Those of you who aren't homesteaded, you might live in another state and have a vacation home here. Chances are you don't vote in the same numbers that you do if you're homesteaded. So if you want to know why tax reform is so hard, look in the mirror. The politicians do the same voter polling we do, and you all don't want tax reform. To the average voter, including our members at the chamber, is, hey, it's good if you pay more and I pay less. But this country right now, and this state specifically, is not willing to pay differently and pay more for the long term. You would rather pay less and hope somebody else pays more. And I'm not saying that's good policy. I'm trying to answer the question of what has to be done. It's going to have to be demanded by the voters of this state is what's going to have to happen. If there was a constitutional amendment on the ballot this fall for tax reform, and some people, you're looking at the guy who led the fight to make it 60%, right? The threshold 60%, that was Amendment 3. They would never pass. So tax reform is something a lot of people talk about, but until the voters of the state demand it, it's a non-starter. And I wish that wasn't the case. I just think we got to be honest with each other about the real challenge.
One of the things that has amazed me as a relatively new citizen, 9 years of Florida, was we did, the Collins Institute did a survey several years ago, and we asked people about whether Florida was a low-tax state. And what we found was there was an enormous difference from how long you'd lived in Florida. People who had been here, who were very recently here and remembered what the property taxes were back in Michigan and New Jersey, all said, no, yes, it's a low-tax state. But then the longer they're here, they start believing it's a high-tax state. And so somehow this perception that we're a high-tax state is out there, although the evidence, as you say, is clearly not that way. Okay, one thing more on when we talk about state government, and that is we've talked about higher education and we've talked about some other issues, education in general. Is there anything else that you'd like to see state government do that they haven't done? Tax reform, beside tax reform?
Well, when you think about the role of government, you think about law enforcement, first of all, and the court system. And I think most people agree, and particularly businesses, are having a hard time getting access to the court system. So that's an area that needs quite a bit of attention. We've already talked about education. We talk about transportation. Florida is notorious for not getting the transportation dollars we send to Washington back in a fair or equivalent amount. And we know, those of us who live down south know, that we have a number of transportation challenges. We live in Florida because we love our quality of life here, and we love our environment. And I think some of the moves that the legislature has made in recent years and the administration to do away with growth management laws and not to pay so much attention to our environmental quality, whether it's water quality or air quality, are very disturbing and concerning to many, many Floridians.
Well, I think that in terms of what could the government do, again, you know, my perspective is that the government doesn't create jobs. The government creates the business climate. And we're doing quite well on most of the six pillars, but the one pillar called business competitiveness, business climate, Florida's actually, of all the indications, you could go to the floridascorecard.com and look this up for yourself, but we're headed absolutely in the wrong direction on making Florida more competitive. There are costs of doing business that state government artificially inflates. So lawsuit abuse reform is an example that costs every family in this room $2,600 a year. And the national rankings, Florida has the 42nd worst legal climate in the United States. And if you're a site selection group and you're looking at where are you going to invest $10 million, you're not going to go to a state that has a reputation for a lot of lawsuit abuse. And so I wish that the legislature as a whole would look at what's in the best interest of growing the private sector over the next 10 years. And then we don't need to be number one in legal climate, but we ought to at least be somewhere in the middle of the pack and not we shouldn't be at the bottom 10 of anything. And I think that's one of the things that we could do is put the long-term interest of the health of the business community ahead of the short-term politics.
I do have to say that I've done extensive traveling around the state in the last 5 years, going to many local chambers of commerce, talking to small businesses, and they have never put lawsuit reform or tort reform on their list of their primary concerns. Their concerns have been more these issues that I mentioned before, access to capital, regulations, being able to get talented employees here. And so I think that when we have had some very bad rankings come out, I agree with Mark in terms of attractiveness for business, but it's because we have a reputation for not having a good public education system. And it's for other reasons, I believe, than legal reforms that companies are hesitant to move here. And let me just add that one of the issues we want to explore in more depth at the foundation is this issue of attracting young people and making Florida an environment where young people want to come and live. Too many of our young people are choosing to either leave the state or not come here because they'd rather work in Raleigh or New York City or Austin, Texas, or Atlanta. And our cities need to work on their living climate in terms of transportation, easy transportation, living close to their place of work, cost of living, creating a cultural environment that seemed to be exciting and fun and dynamic. And in a recent poll that we did, 65% of our young people under the age of 35 said that they would consider leaving the state for a better job opportunity. So we've got to address this issue of the brain drain in our state.
If I could, this is such an important issue. I was talking to Sue Dick, who runs the Tallahassee Chamber, just recently about this. Almost everybody in this room, if you were a senior in high school or a junior senior in college, and mom and dad said, tell me about the job you're thinking about after you graduate, almost everybody in this room mentioned a company, even if it was in New Jersey or someplace like Minnesota. Today's junior and senior in college, when mom and dad ask that question, they're saying, I want to go to Raleigh. I want to go to Austin. I want to go to Denver. And our generation is saying, no, I asked you about the job. And see, this next generation of talent, it's not about the job. It's about the quality of life. And so I tell every local chamber and EDO or corporate CEO that wants to ask, what do we have to do over the next 10 years to win that game? You have to focus on quality of life. Make your community a place where these kids want to live, where they want to raise a family, where they want to make their career. Just ask Bill Gates about this. The reason Microsoft is building more and more facilities around the world is they're building facilities where the talent is. The talent's no longer going halfway around the world to get to where the job is. And that's a major generational change. I just want to underscore what the point Alex made.
Carol, let me read something that I saw on the plane. I flew down here last night, and I was looking at the U.S. Airways magazine, and they have a spread about Charlotte. And this is what they say. Of course, it's promotional, but Charlotte defines what it means to be a new American city. We embrace diversity and welcome newcomers and businesses that seek both to do well and do good. We are not afraid of change. We embrace it, a tenaciousness we have shared for many generations. And this issue of diversity is incredibly important. So whether we're talking about racial diversity, economic diversity, sexual orientation diversity, young people don't want to come and live in communities that don't embrace diversity. And that's an issue that some of our local communities around the state really need to address.
Terrific. Okay, we're going to open it up for a couple of questions now before we shift gears a little bit and talk about the federal role in the economy. So do I have any questions? Yeah, let's have one for the
audience. Anyone in the audience have a question you want to actually ask? Okay, Neil.
Cool. All right. I've been thinking about this. The current governor came into office as a very committed budget cutter. And we just passed a budget of $69.9 billion. The one at the end of the Crist administration for, I think it was fiscal 2011, was $70.4 billion, which means that this one is 0.7% smaller. So here's a multiple choice question.
A bubble question. Good.
Bubble. I can do this. I have taught in Florida University. Which of the following is the case? Has the governor concluded that the current level of spending is about right after all? Has he lost the political will to make the cuts? Or C, does he lack the skills to go find the cuts he thought were there?
Does there need to be a D?
Yeah, none of the above.
You may elaborate, however, on your answer.
Well, since I don't talk to the governor, I wouldn't know.
Well, I think you ought to try it sometime. He's a really smart guy. I would invite maybe when Don comes up. Don was there under the last budget under Chris that I think you were talking about, and there were a lot of stimulus dollars in and around that time as well that I think we really need to figure out. Is that part of the number? Is it not? What I found is this. I think we have 1,100 lobbyists that are registered to lobby in this town. We give 2,100 bills in an average year, 300 pass. So to give you an example, something I think you discovered when you were CFO, we have 26 state agencies, and we use, I think, 17 different payroll systems. So as CFO, Alex couldn't run financials. And some agencies run payroll every 2 weeks, some run every month, some once a week. And guess what? Every payroll vendor has a lobbyist. No company in America would run their business that way. You wouldn't run a company that way. I wouldn't run a company that way. So there's decades of embedded inefficiencies and waste, if you will, that are in the system. I think you have a governor that's never run in political office before, who I think his first year was an incredible learning opportunity for him. I saw this governor, I had a lot of experience this year. And I think he went in, and I think he began cutting certain places. He began in his second year, in my opinion, prioritizing what needed to be cut or what needed to be invested in. And I think that the fact that we've gone 2 years in a row where New York and Illinois have increased their corporate income taxes and even in Illinois their personal income taxes to make it up. So I completely get the metric of where we were before versus now. In legislative terms, I think we had a $3 or $4 billion gap the first year and a $1.78 billion gap this year. And both of those were closed with no new taxes or fees. So from my perspective, I think that I couldn't answer the question of does he think that $70 billion budget is the right number or not. We invest about $30 billion in education when you go all in on that. And so what I hope is that this next year he continues the discussion about are we investing our dollars in the priorities, if you will. So I think the answer is that he's committed to not spend more than we have and to make sure that every single program, if you look at his veto messages, what's the return on investment, whether it's a $250,000 item or a $250 million item. And that's just not something we had over the last 4 years.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on. I have lots of good questions, and maybe you have too, but I don't want to forget Don, because we're going to move now to the federal government and what it's done and what it might do concerning the economy. And we have with us tonight Don Winstead, who was the stimulus czar, such a great name, under Governor Charlie Crist, and who's continued to monitor the federal stimulus dollars coming into the state. My last count, I think it's $26 billion that the state of Florida got, something like that, in stimulus dollars, and relates to Neil's question and to Mark's response. Don Winstead was a special advisor to Governor Crist for the implementation of the Federal American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, the stimulus bill. And he served before that as Deputy Secretary of Florida Department of Children and Families for a total of 8 years, serving 4 secretaries and 3 governors. That's pretty interesting in 8 years. He served for 4 years as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Human Services Policy at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services during the George W. Bush administration under Secretary Tommy Thompson. He's a nationally recognized expert on federal funding issues, and we are delighted to have with us tonight Don Winstead. So, Don, what happened to those $26 billion, and what did that do for Florida's economy?
Well, we were on a pathway to get something a little bit above 26, and then we lost the high-speed rail money. So it's probably now going to come in about $25 billion. Let me first quickly explain the federal budget, and that will take just a second, and then the stimulus money.
Yay!
The best overall description that I've ever heard of the federal government was by a former technical staffer in the White House who said it helps to think of the federal budget and the federal government as an insurance company with an army. And when you think about it, that's true. I mean, you've read the stories this week about Social Security and Medicare. And largely what drives federal expenditures are the entitlement programs, various social insurance programs. I would say the corollary with the state budget is that it helps to think of the state government as an insurance company with the school system. And in many ways, a lot of the drivers there are also some of those same demographic factors and the same social insurance factors. To Neil's question about the drivers in the budget, part of that's driven by things that are already plugged in, Medicaid. Being one of the huge, over $20 billion in Florida out of that about $70 billion amount. So a lot of those things are already kind of pre-programmed. Now, in terms of the stimulus, it's easy to get lost in the numbers, but let me ask you to imagine 3 overall buckets on the stage. And the overall stimulus, you'll recall, was $787 billion was the national number. Now, that's been revised since, and the latest number from the Congressional Budget Office is $831 billion. And the reason it went up was largely extended unemployment benefits and increased food stamp benefits that were part of that. Those are two of the big drivers there. Now, Florida's share of that, $25 billion is the money coming into the state. There's another part that almost I think everybody has just forgotten about that's about a $15 billion part. So let me do it in three buckets. Bucket one are grants and contracts and loans coming into the state from federal agencies, much of which flowed through state agencies. Some flowed directly to local government or sub-state organizations. That bucket for Florida is about $11 billion. About three-fourths of that has been spent, but it is still going on. I offer as evidence of that, if some people saw in the paper either this morning or yesterday morning, a picture of the vice president touring the Everglades in an airboat reviewing a stimulus project down there. So there are things still going on. But about $11 billion will be coming there. Second big bucket is entitlement funds. And the three big parts of that were increased Medicaid dollars coming to the state because of changing the matching arrangement, extended unemployment benefits paid for by the federal government coming to the state, and increases in food stamp benefits that were done in the Recovery Act. That bucket for Florida is about $14 billion. And the two of those, 11 and 14, is the $25 billion or so overall. The third bucket that people have forgotten about is tax relief. Part of the Recovery Act, part of the stimulus, was the Making Work Pay tax credit. Most people here got $400 each in an extra tax credit in 2009 and 2010. If anybody bought a new home, the first-time homeowner tax credit. There were a number of tax relief provisions. All told, that was about $300 billion nationally. For Florida, if you look at, although the federal government has never released state-by-state figures on that, if you look at the averages, maybe $15 billion for Florida. So 11, 14, 15, total about 40 if you count in the tax relief. If you just count in the benefits, the contracts, grants, loans, and benefits, about $25 billion. And if you compare that against a roughly $70 billion state budget, you see the impact, that it's a significant amount of money that came into the state. It's fading now pretty rapidly. The big years were 2009 to 2010 and into 11. About midway through 2011 started to fade, and now it's pretty rapidly fading now.
That will have to be the last word for the recorded portion of our program. We'd like to thank our special guests, Alex Sink, Mark Wilson, and Don Winstead, and, of course, our moderator, Dr. Carol Weissert, for joining us this evening. We hope you'll join us Monday, May 7th for Our Town Fast Forward, an evening about everything new in Tallahassee, co-sponsored by KCCI, Leadership Tallahassee, the Tallahassee Democrat, and Access Tallahassee. This program was recorded live at St. John's Episcopal Church in downtown Tallahassee. The Village Square is committed to civil and constructive public dialogue on the issues that matter to our community, our state, and our nation. Find us online at tothevillagesquare.org. Thank you for joining us, and good night.